Roll call, Director Whitaker.
Here.
Director Nguyen. Director Yeo.
Here.
Director Tran.
Here.
Director Wiegand.
Here.
Director Bilodeau.
Here.
Director Sheldon.
Here.
Director Meeks. Director Mezqua. Director Green.
Here.
You do have a quorum of your committee.
Thank you. General Manager Kennedy, are there any items received you'd like to be agendized?
There are none.
Time is now for set aside for visitor participation. So if there's anyone attending this meeting that wishes to address the committee. All right, is there anyone online with a hand raised?
There is not.
All right, with that, we will go to our consent calendar. We have five items on the consent calendar. Is there any item we need to be pulled to talk about?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the consent calendar.
Thank you, Director Nguyen.
I'll second.
And second by Director Wiegand.
Roll call, Director Whitaker.
Aye.
Director Yeo.
Yes.
Director Tran.
Aye.
Director Wiegand.
Yes.
Director Bilodeau. Director Sheldon.
I probably
yeah, should yes. Vote.
Yeah, just let's go with Director Sheldon.
That motion carries 5-0.
And our items today, we have an informational item number 6, proposed fiscal year 24-25 water purchase budget.
Yes, Chris Olson will present this to the committee.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Whitaker, members of the board. Clear these out really quickly. All right, one more. Okay.
This should be a short presentation.
It will be. So the fiscal year 24-25 proposed water budget. So the budget schedule that you have all seen several times by now, and we'll see a few more times. We are here today at Water Issues looking at the water budget. Earlier about an hour ago, we went through this with the producers as well. So looking at the pie chart here of our total budget, $247.6 million. The water budget is $6 million of that. And to get to the details of it, main components are Alamitos barrier water purchase of 3,000 acre feet for $4.3 million. We are not buying any Met water this coming fiscal year. We also didn't buy any this year. The other components are the Metropolitan Readiness to Serve charge, and that's based on a four-year average when we did take water previously 2 years ago and the year before that. Also, MODOC groundwater charge and a capacity charge, which gets us to our $6 million for the total water budget. So just taking a look at where we are at with our groundwater basin accumulated overdraft, this graph shows our recommended target overdraft as 150,000 to 200,000 acre feet. As of June 30th of last year, we were at 189,000. And just projecting into June 30th of this year, it's looking to be 168,000, which is 21,000 acre feet to the better. So all in all, the basin's in great shape. We've had a lot, couple of good heavy rain years. There's a little bit lower water demand, and the basin overall is doing great. Looking at the water balance for the upcoming fiscal year, using average conditions with Santa Ana River base flow at 75,000 acre feet, storm flows 58,000, incidental recharge 49,000, expecting GWRS to do about 128,000, and then we have Alamitos barrier for at 3,000. That total is 313,000 acre feet going into the basin. And we're expecting roughly 292,000 acre feet of pumping at our 85% BPP. So that's where that 21,000 to the good comes in, 21,000 acre feet. And we're just forecasting for the next 3 to 4 years or so. This is likely going to be the case just with lower demands. We've had a couple of good years of rain. The basin's very healthy right now. We could be seeing this kind of number every year for the next couple of years as we look at the water balance and the overdraft. So a couple of scenarios. If we had another wet year, that overdraft would drop down to 98,000 acre feet. An average year, 148,000. That's that 20,000 acre foot projection that it would be still to the good on an average year. And then a dry year would still actually be in our target operating range at 198,000. So once again, the basin's in great condition right now. And something new that we haven't shown before is taking a look at our service territory, just the water supply sources based on total demands of 370,000 acre feet. So when you add up the Santa Ana River base flows, storm flows, incidental recharge, GWRS, miscellaneous is the recycled water, there's only a need for about 40,000 acre feet of imported water, which is an all-time low here. So again, it's doing great. This is an informational item. Can receive committee comments. Again, we did discuss this with producers and there were no comments.
Chris, any questions or comments by members of the committee?
I'd like to make one comment. Chris, if you could go back to the pie chart, just the imported water slice of the pie there. 15 years ago, that was well over 100,000 acre feet of met water we needed, maybe even closer to 150,000 acre feet of met water that we needed. And this is total water demands of the 19 producers. But it's a great news story that we've slowly reduced how much imported water we need, and we're down to about 40,000 acre feet a year now for a typical year. So
how many millions of dollars would that have been a couple of years ago?
I can calculate that, but yeah, not off the top of my head.
Reminds me of that old song, Pennies from Heaven, right? Tens of millions of dollars from heaven.
Yeah, it definitely tens of millions of savings of avoiding all that imported water. Yeah.
Any comments or questions?
Director Yeo has his hand raised.
Sure, Director Yeo.
Thank you, Chair Whitaker. Chris, thank you for your excellent 5-minute presentation. Can you go back to second slide about the Alamitos barrier? Yeah, I have a question here that I remember a few months ago, we talked about the GWRS, we had to dial down on the production. Do we, and if we were able to supply water to the Alamitos barrier, then we don't have to pay Long Beach for this, right?
That is correct, if we did, yeah.
Yeah, if we did. And do we have any conveyance to reach out to that area? Or if not, how much are we talking about building something? Like in, or is it even something that we should venture into, you know, the probability of this happening, how great it is? Is it going to be a good investment? Just something in general.
You want that? Well, with Director Yeo, with the Sunset Gap work we're doing to determine what type of barrier we're going to need at Sunset Gap, we're also looking at the source of water that we could be injecting over at the Sunset Gap. And one of the options is to build a pipeline from the GWRS over to that area of the basin. So we're gonna have some numbers this spring, and if we got the water to the Sunset Gap, it'd be pretty easy to get it all the way over to the Alamitos barrier. So we'll have some numbers like you're asking about this spring that we can share with the committee.
Okay, great. Thank you. And a couple slides later, when you're talking about one more, I think. Okay, so we're go. Yeah, yes, this one. So we're gonna have some incidental recharge that is not known at this time, and I think Roy's group is probably collecting the water table information right now, right? We should have some information come May or June of this year to know what the contour of the groundwater basin is like, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and then so if it's closer to 98 than to 148, we probably would consider upping the BPP some more, because we don't want it to be too full.
Yeah, Director Yeo, that may not be a very good option right now, because a lot of wells have been taken offline due to PFAS. And so for the year we're in right now, when producers pump above the BPP, they pay the additional basin equity assessment charge. But we have reduced the basin equity assessment charge in the year we're in now by $200 an acre foot to encourage more pumping out of the groundwater basin. But we don't expect to get a whole lot. And also in next fiscal year, we're going to recommend the same thing, to lower the BEA to encourage producers to pump above 85%. But we don't expect to get a whole lot of extra pumping. So right now, in the next few years, raising the BPP to 100% would not do much, just because of the situation we're in with a lot of wells being offline. But in the future, once we get all the PFAS systems constructed, then what you were saying would be a good idea to get extra pumping if it was needed.
Okay, thank you. I'm just thinking about maybe a decade ago, when we had a really wet year, that the basin was too full, to the point that we were observing some artesian wells in Huntington Beach area. So hopefully we don't get into that type of scenario again. So
yeah, okay. and that's exactly why we're not recommending to buy any met water, to not create a problem like you're describing. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, John and Chris. I have no further questions.
Any other comments or questions?
None.
It's interesting, John, that even in wet years, we have ample problems. So with this, that's an informational item, and it's a good segue now to our next item, which is forecast informed reservoir operations here at Prado Dam, completion of final environmental implementation roadmap. And I think it's a good segue, because what's happening with Hero and the Prado are going to also reduce our reliance on imported supplies.
Yes. So Lisa Haney and Adam Hutchison are going to, you tag team, you're going to tag team this.
Thanks. Thank you, member of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here today. Talk about the final viability assessment for Prado, as well as implementation roadmap going forward. If you remember, 3 weeks ago, we had Dr. Marty Ralph here from the Center of Western Weather and Water Extreme to talk about FIRO, and he touched upon the final viability assessment. So we wanted to spend a little more time, dig into it, dig into the results, and then Lisa is going to talk about where do we go from here, making this a permanent change at Prado Dam. So I'll go forward. Okay, so we've been doing water conservation at Prado Dam for a long time, going back to the 1960s. Currently, we are able to hold up to 20,000 acre feet of water. That's what we have right now today as we speak, and that's at elevation 505. And so it took a lot of time and years to get to that spot. And now FIRO is trying to go farther and go above 505. And what elevation we get to is something we'll talk about later. But as we consider holding more water behind Prado Dam, it's not so simple. It's not just holding more water. There's a lot of factors to consider, such as the flood risk management capacity of the dam. That's primary. It can never be violated. We have endangered species behind the dam. We have habitat. We have infrastructure like the Corona Airport. We have all these different factors that we need to consider. And this is why the final viability assessment is so important, because we can look at all these different factors together as a cohesive, holistic view of what's happening. And so, as Dr. Marty Ralph mentioned, atmospheric rivers are critical to California in terms of wet and dry years. And we've really come a long way in our forecast ability to look at atmospheric rivers, when they're hitting, how strong they're going to be. And so our ability to forecast these storms is really underlying and foundational to making FIRO work. And so what is FIRO? Well, this is kind of a nice diagram that shows kind of the evolution of FIRO, and we have improved forecast. That's critical. We need to have good forecast information. then that translates into better runoff models, into products, so you know what's coming and how fast. And then the Corps of Engineers can use this information to proactively manage the dam versus reactively as they've done in the past. And as a result, this leads, in our case, to maximizing stormwater capture, reduce flood risk downstream, and environmental opportunity. There might be opportunity to really enhance the environment with FERO rather than degrading it. So I wanted to give you a quick picture of how FERO has already benefited us already. This graphic here shows what happened back in early February. We had a big AR hit the watershed, and the blues, dark blue line shows the water level behind Prater Dam going up above the red line, which is our water conservation limit at 505. And in the past, the Corps would have tried to pre-release this water to prevent the water from getting over 505. But because we have these new tools in place, they now are more comfortable going over 505 and then slowly draining the water down to 505, which they actually did this previous storm we just had a few weeks ago, as well as this particular case where they drained it slowly. And so we were able to capture water during that time period, even though some of it was going to the ocean, we were able to capture some of that water and divert it into our system during this time. So even though FERO is not permanently in place yet, we're still getting the benefits of all the work that we've already done to implement FERO. This graphic here kind of showed the value of water conservation by Prado going back to 1990, which is when we got to elevation 494. So that really started the process of us raising the limit up to 505 as it is today. So this shows you the value of the water we retain behind Prater Dam every year in terms of the dollar value of met untreated water. So the bars are the total value for that particular year based on if you were to buy an equivalent amount of water using the met untreated rate for that year. So last year, you know, it was a really wet year, and you can see the bar on the far right there. The total value of that water was over $40 million worth of water if you had to buy that from Metropolitan. So the total value over the whole 34-year time period is almost $500 million. And with MET rate projected to increase pretty rapidly in the next 10 years, it's only going to get more valuable and critical to keep capturing stormwater behind Prater Dam. So the final viability assessment started back in 2017 with a very definitive phased approach. We had a multi-agency steering committee led by Dr. Marty Ralph. And so we started in 2017 with the phase one scoping study and finished in November 2023. The report has been published. And what I wanted to mention here was that we were really fortunate to get in on the ground level on the FERO pilot study that the federal government was doing through the Army Corps of Engineers. The very first pilot study was Lake Mendocino with Sonoma County Water Agency. And Grant Davis and Mike Marcus were good friends. And Grant said, hey, why don't you do this at Prado? And Mike said, sure, great idea. So we jumped in line. And so we were the second pilot project behind Lake Mendocino. And so over the course of time, since we finished the FBA, we've spent $1.7 million of our own money, but because we're a pilot project in the federal program, we received approximately $7 million of support from the federal government. So 80% of the work that we're doing here has been paid for by our involvement with the federal government in this project. So a tremendous financial benefit by being the second pilot project in the nation. So we published the report. It's on our website. You can feel free to download it and read it by your bedside. And so I'm just going to cover the quick highlights here. Basically, the report recommended raising the maximum water level anywhere between 510 and 512. That elevation is yet to be determined. We're talking with the Corps of Engineers and might have to do some additional work to fine tune that. But if we were to raise it to 510 to 512, that would represent 4,000 to 6,000 acre feet per year on average every year, not per year, but on average every year. And that's about 10% increase in flood stormwater recharge. FERO has a slightly positive effect on flood risk management. That's because the Corps had these tools. They know what's coming so they can get in front of it. And we need to do additional research to understand the environmental effects. And Lisa will touch on that more. So with that, I'll pass it over to Lisa to talk about implementation.
Thank you, Adam. I want to pause for just a minute to recognize
let me, that. Let me interrupt you for a moment. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Adam before Lisa starts. That. Should I hold that question or should I ask it now or ask everything at the very end? What do you
prefer? It'd be great if we could hold it till the end because I might cover it in my next portion.
Yeah, or you might not, but I'll be happy to hold it. I'll be happy to hold it. Not a problem. I just wanted to ask. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, great. Again, I just wanted to pause for a moment before continuing the presentation to thank Adam for his leadership in leading the organization through the final viability analysis. It was a lot of work, and we're at a wonderful point where staff can now recommend that we actually implement FIRO as the formal process moving forward. And that's what I'd like to talk to you about today. What we're recommending, how we would move forward, what that would look like, and what we need to work on. Right now, you guys, most everyone knows that we're working on a minor deviation application to raise our elevation to 508 behind Prado Dam to store more stormwater. We're in process with that. We hope to have that complete by the end of this year. We are continuing during this minor deviation time to continue to develop our research and tools. These tools are turned into policies and procedures for the water control manual on how to operate the dam moving forward. So really understanding these tools, developing them properly, and having them finalized is critical. We also need to better understand how we're affecting the environment behind Prado Dam. Anytime we hold water behind the dam, there is an inundation of habitat that affects endangered species as well. And we need to better understand our effect of holding water with real metrics and quantifiable analysis. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit more detail. And then, of course, ultimately, we want to incorporate all these environmental tools and weather forecasting informed tools for the final operation of the water control manual update number 2. This graphic illustrates different models for the different elevations based on historic data in the past. And we can run climate or weather models for these elevations based for wet years, dry years, or different scenarios. And what we've done is we've looked at all of those models, we've pulled the average of those models and estimated a rough average per year of what we would gain doing FIRO over time. If we were to go to 508, it would roughly be 2,000 acre feet of extra stormwater. And it'd be another 2,000 acre feet if we went to 510, and then another if we went to 512 for a maximum of 6,000 acre feet of water. And as Adam mentioned earlier, the cost of and value of that water increases over time. We have been early adopters as an agency of stormwater capture, and that has really paid off financially for our organization. That's going to continue to pay off. So every drop really does matter. How far are we going to go? How far can we go? These are really good questions, and we're still trying to answer those. Prado Dam has an airport that was constructed in the floodplain behind the dam, and that is a limiting factor for how far we can hold water to what elevation. The airport, Corona Airport, is at an elevation of 514, so that is our limit. There is a flood control response by Army Corps of Engineers to not flood the airport. They also need a little bit of a buffer to ensure that they're not flooding the airport. So you can't take it straight to 514. So the question is, how far can we go? Is 510 the safety buffer, or can we do 512 and still keep the airport within a safe flood risk? In February, we had back-to-back storms. We had a lot of water. And we've been practicing with our FIRO tools with the Army Corps. They were kind enough to hold water to an elevation of 512 to see what that would look like, because they're starting to have comfort with these tools. Unfortunately, what happened is that one of the hangars at the airport reported flooding at 512. So now that raises a safety flood concern for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and we are investigating where that hangar is and why did that happen. There's a couple reasons that that could have happened. There may have been water coming from another area that wasn't put into the model, backwater filling up from behind. So other confounding factors that weren't put into the model originally. We've already had a meeting with CW3E to adjust the models to better understand other sources of water that are coming in around that area that could affect the elevation and water inundation. We're also going to go talk to the owner of the hangar and see how many hangars there are at that elevation level and what alternatives we might have to maybe move those hangars to a higher elevation or build dikes or protective measures that would help prevent flooding if we were to go to a 512 elevation level. With any elevation change, there is a change in risk to environmental factors behind the dam. As I mentioned before, holding water behind the dam physically translates into habitat being underwater for a specific period of time. And as we hold water at higher elevations, that habitat is underwater for a longer period of time. So there's a more of a mitigation risk. Under the minor deviation for 508, we have an approved draft of the environmental conditions. These are the new conditions under that application. So it's the difference between 505 and 508, that new land strip, we would now need to monitor for that. And that would need to be considered for vireo monitoring, for mitigation work, and habitat. One of the things that has been in discussion with U.S. Fish and Wildlife over the last year since I've been here is that the metrics we've been historically using for our past biological opinions, those metrics aren't working. We were using something called the stacked cube method. It was the best effort at the time and the best science available at the time, but it really doesn't quantify anything or make sense to anybody, doesn't make sense to the regulators, and it doesn't really make sense to staff either. So what we've decided to do is develop a new tool, and we have until the end of this year to have a metric that would actually portray our impact to the environment. Right now, and in the past, we've been guessing what's been happening, and we've been paying for that. What I would like to do and suggest is that we have a more scientific and metric-based quantification method of what we are actually doing out there and only pay for what we are doing, not just guessing. And the way to do that is to integrate different known sources of data that we have into one model that would be a better predictor, hopefully, than what we're doing now, which is guessing. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit more in the next slide. We also have a sediment obligation that's part of every biological opinion. This is 1,141 cubic yards of sediment every year. I talked with Ben. He gave me a cost estimate that it's $5,705 per year for 5 years to remove sediment, and that would be from the River Road area. That's just to move it out of the river and put it in stockpile it close by. That's not including any kind of transportation cost associated with that, to move it to a coastal area. We do have plans in the works right now that I wanted to let you know about. One of the biggest barriers to sediment removal is sediment transportation. We have sediment. There are people who desperately need sediment. The cost of getting it from point A to point B is insurmountable, literally. People can't pay to come get it, and we can't pay to transport it. And people don't also know what's available in the area. In Northern California, SFEI, the San Francisco Estuary Institute, created a sediment dating app Okay, you upload your sediment profile and you hope to find a match, right? And this allows everyone to see what's available, what the profile is, and if anyone needs that profile. We have reached out to SFEI and asked them if we could work collaboratively with them to develop that into a statewide tool, and specifically for Southern California. We need a way to partner with others for sediment. We need to figure out who needs it, but we also need to figure out how to fund the transportation. So we're also looking to form a grant consortium that where we collectively apply for grants to help fund the transportation costs to get it. Once there is a match, they can get it from point A to point B. So that's a project that we're working on right now. I also have a grant in submission with SCWRP, which is our local research agency. And it's through NOAA. It's a planning grant. This grant, if awarded, would allow us to do workshops and get the word out about this application and help educate people how to use it, and then look for regulatory drivers that would maybe force people to use it so that we can have more opportunities for matches. The other obligation at the end is the riparian habitat monitoring and reporting. This is our mitigation requirement. So if we do have a loss of any riparian habitat that is greater than 30% after 2 years, we do need to mitigate for that loss of habitat. If it's less than 30%, we don't have to do anything. We don't have to pay for anything. But again, the percent over 30, whatever that is, it's a one-to-one ratio for mitigation. And that would be our obligation. So we would be tracking that over a two-year time period. I want to talk more about the habitat tool. It's a multi-benefit habitat assessment tool. And the idea is to really understand when we have a habitat loss, what is the cause of that loss? There are a lot of different factors that could be causing that. It may not just be inundation of water. This biological opinion forces us to do mitigation for inundation of water. If we have a loss of habitat that is due to something else, that would not count. So we need to really understand how the environment is doing. So this would look at groundwater coming in, because groundwater is essential for habitat health. It would look at climate, and it would look at time of inundation. We're also looking at research studies using the wetlands and the Prado wetlands to do inundation studies of plants and understand exactly how many days of inundation does it take. Like a toxicity test for plants, right? To kill the plant, because we don't know and we're guessing, and the regulators are using the guess to bill us for mitigation. So we want to have real science and real data to make informed decisions for mitigation. And that's what we're working towards. This is a tool that not only would be immediately necessary for us to move to higher elevations, it would also be necessary for others in the watershed as a mitigation metric tool and regulatory tool. So this could potentially be a tool that would impact the rest of the watershed. I have put together a roadmap and a proposal for how we would build this tool. I've talked with the regulators. They support this development. I've talked to other watershed stakeholders, and I've also talked to modelers at the Army Corps of Engineers. Everyone thinks that this is a viable methodology to try. It's not a guarantee. We have to build it first to see if it works, but you have to start somewhere. And they all think this is a great innovative tool to move forward with. This would help have a metric quantifiable method. It would have informed decision making, just like what we're doing for FIRO, but for not just climate, but for weather forecasting, but for environment. And then it gives us visualization and automation tools to help us manage the area appropriately. So let's talk about timelines. Where are we? How long is it going to take to get into full implementation? Right now, this is where we are. The Army Corps of Engineers is updating their water control manual to incorporate the construction of their spillway I know you have heard about that construction. So they have to modify their control manual based on that new construction. We have nothing to do with this process. We are just watching them. But in parallel to this process, we are going to start another process, which we are involved in. What we want to do is we want to start incorporating these new tools that have been developed into the Water Control Manual Update Number 2. And it's going to be done in parallel, overlapping the Water Control Update Number 1. And we're using this minor deviation for 508 as our little playground to develop the tools, fine-tune them, and finalize them so that they can be put into the Water Control Manual. So where are we with our 508 deviation application? It's a great question. We had hoped to be done last year. Unfortunately, there was a cultural component that was not recognized in the application process initially. The cultural component is very much like an environmental component. You have to assess the new area between 505 and 508 for any cultural areas of significance. And if there are areas that are found, they have to be investigated, and there could be cultural mitigation associated with those sites, depending on what they are. Like many siloed agencies, not always in Army Corps of Engineers do the different departments talk to one another. So unfortunately, cultural was never brought in at the beginning of the project. They were brought in at the end, and it was flagged that this analysis had not been completed. So we've been working since October last year to have these analyses completed, except it's been raining so much. So all of these sites are underwater, and we cannot get an archaeologist out there to visit and verify the sites. So we are asking that it please stop raining, because this is holding up our application process. As soon as the pool can recede and dry out enough, then we can send an archaeologist out there and we can get a determination. It's a little bit of a black box. We did have around 10 sites identified in this area, and they all need to be investigated, and we don't know yet how significant those findings are. So if they are significant, there will be further work that is needed before we can finish this application. We are hoping for the best, that nothing more will be needed and we can continue forward. Everything else is ready to go. The biological opinion has already been accepted, and all the other aspects have been accepted. It would just need to go through public review and final stamp of approval, which we already have assurances from the Army Corps of Engineers. We hope to have this all done by the end of this year, everything dependent upon cultural findings. Moving forward, we are needing to keep refining the decision support tools, which is our weather forecasting that is specific to Prado, but that also translates into operational procedures. How much can you release and at what time, depending on what's happening. But additionally, U.S. Fish and Wildlife has said they are not going to let us continue to a higher elevation until we have this new environmental tool metric completed. So this is a high priority item, and we will be stuck at 508 until we can figure out this new metric. So the costs, we're talking about money today. There are costs associated with everything. We are suggesting implementing this, and the cost to keep moving forward is over a 3-year time period. We would continue to pay CW3E to develop and fine-tune their forecasting models. Not only that, the reason the budget is going up is because Seven Oaks Dam in the Northern Watershed has decided to start their viability analysis for FERO. And we're having a coordination ensemble between the two dams. So we also need tools developed on how the Seven Oaks Dam would be affecting Prado Dam should they implement FERO. So that's a whole nother new set of tools that needs to be developed. Additionally, we are going to need their support to develop the environmental model because the forecasting piece needs to go into the environmental model. So there's a little more work that needs to be done. And the bulk of that work will be the first year, and then we see that declining over the next 2 years. We have put into the budget, the planning department budget, some money to help do a pilot of this environmental tool. And we've suggested 100K for the first year and to be determined as we go. We want to see if the first year there's any viability before projecting or suggesting we move it further. So this would be an initial investment. We also have to pay for Army Corps of Engineers time. They're kind of like a consultant. They bill based on projects. So they bill to collaborate with us. So it's part of the general manager's budget to pay for their time and coordination. And then they did receive federal funding for $500,000 to work on the water control manual update number 2 to implement FIRO. That is half the cost of what they need to actually complete the manual. So we are looking for funding opportunities for sediment and the sediment dating app. We have a grant in for that. We're looking for funding and grant opportunities for the environmental tool. I am asking, once I have proof of life for the tool, that other agencies maybe cost share for the future development of that tool, or we have grant funding to help supplement that. And that's it. So we are here today to recommend moving forward, and this would be the process of moving forward and the steps that we would need to complete to move forward. And we are ready to take questions.
Thank you. I have Director Sheldon first in the queue, question-wise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could go back to Adam. Adam, could you pull up the slide regarding the surplus or the extra that was at behind Prado over the 505. I think you had a slide that showed that graph. There you go. So I believe that you'd commented that is part of the math on how much water that the district received. And I wanted to ask you of that extra water over the 505 and what other extra water you're counting. I understand it was behind Prado. But it's my recollection that when the Corps was releasing that, it was at such a velocity, we could not capture it all. And so I want to kind of go back and peel back how much of that actually got into our basin versus what was stored behind Prado.
Yeah, it's a great question, Director Sheldon. I would have to work with Ben Smith to kind of dig into the details and find out exactly what we were able to capture during that time period that in a normal operation, what would we have lost? But you can see the release rate on the orange line on the graph is like 7,500 CFS. So we obviously can't capture anything there, but they did lower it down pretty low. I'm not sure what the exact number is. Ben Smith could probably talk to that, but they did release go down pretty low, and we were able to capture water during that time period. We can get back to you with a quantification of what we were able to capture this season. Given the way the Corps operated, I think that would be a great exercise for us to go through. So if you'd give us a little bit of time, we'll get back to you with a number on that.
So while the Corps was draining that part over 505 at that point in time, how much of that were we capturing at that point? And I remember there was a lot that unfortunately that we were not capturing. The average, I think you said, was 4,000 to 6,000 acre feet per year is what on average we think that we would garner. And I just, being here long enough, I question, and let me just take a step back. I support the presentation overall. I just want us to know what, in my understanding, what the numbers may actually be as we make these decisions, not to undermine or be against it. I support everything that was said, and I really appreciate the work on the second presentation on the habitat and some of the arrangements we had entered into in past years didn't make the most sense. So, but here, when we average it out, you take the heavy years and you take the years that it's not over 505 at all. I don't think you can, again, use the average because there's points when we're not able to capture that water into our basin. And so just because that's the average of what's stored behind Prado Dam. That doesn't mean that all that water stored behind Prado Dam goes into our basin. I think we need to have a more precise look at what is the actual water getting in, not the water stored behind Prado. You have a comment on that?
Yeah, we can give you some more information about these averages. Averages are an easy way to explain it, but like you said, there are going to be wet years where you're going to lose a lot of water, but you're also going to be able to capture a lot of water. So for example, the 512 elevation, if you dig into the annual recharge on one of those scenarios for 512, it ranges anywhere from 40,000 on a dry year to 250,000 on a wet year. So it really fluctuate greatly depending on the year that you have. So we didn't want to present too many details, but
that's an important detail.
The way to present it.
I just think that the methodology, I think the you know, view that water stored behind Prado equals water in our basin is not correct. It's just not, because we, because when we get water and, you know, we don't get it 24/7, 365. It's those, it's when we all know when we get it. And when we have those intense rains, we're not able to capture all that water that's coming out. So we've got to be more, I think, just more precise with a rifle versus a shotgun as to what we're saying, that water, you know, when water behind Prado is not, it does not equate into water in our basin. But I'd like to hear more when you have that information. Thank you, Adam.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, and we can see if we can get more detailed information, but once the elevation of the water goes down to say 510 or 512 on this chart, then that is when the core lets us control the release rate. And so and then we would tell the core just release 350 CFS, because we knew we could capture 350 CFS. So we kind of control the dam outflow once the water elevation reaches like the 510 or 512, or right now it's 505. And when the water is at 505 or less, then the core will release water at a rate that we can capture. So in general, once you get the water elevation down to these numbers here, then we are capturing all the water being released in general.
Yeah, great point, John. And I'll just... this is in addition to what we already get with 505. So we get a certain volume of capture, like on average, we assume 50,000 acre feet a year of stormwater capture. So this 4,000 to 6,000 would be on top of what we're already getting with the conservation pool. Just want to make that clear.
Right. I understand that. But thank you.
Thank you, Director Villalobos.
Quick question. You mentioned that there may be some operational changes at Seven Oaks Dam in the future. Do you perceive those will result in more or less water for us?
We actually have no idea. That's part of the modeling exercise of the viability analysis. They're just getting started. They haven't even developed the tool sets for us to ascertain that yet. But we are at the table and part of the steering committee to make sure that we're understanding specifically how that's going to affect us. And the Army Corps operates both dams, so they need to interact.
I think the County of Orange operates Seven Oaks, I believe.
Yes.
But anyways, the water district out there bought property from the county in Hemet, and they've created spreading basins, and I'm sure that's why they want to conserve more water, being Seven Oaks, to slowly release that water and put it into their basin. And that's why I'm kind of curious.
Right. That is the purpose.
How that's going to affect us potentially. Thank you.
Yeah, I will keep you updated.
Yeah. Why do we have to pay for the research that Seven Oaks Dam is doing, the effect on Prado? Why wouldn't Seven Oaks Dam pay for that?
So yeah, it's a great question. I asked the same question. What we're doing is it's a coordination effort. So they're looking out on our behalf as well, because they understand the tools. So they can translate those tools to better answer the question that Director Bilodeau just asked. So that they'll help translate those tools into effects on us. Seven Oaks is paying for that, but we are paying for the analysis of the effect for us, for that coordination effort, right? But the tool sets and their time in their own steering committee meetings, they're paying 100% for that. And I do have a breakdown of the budget that outlines that for further detail.
Director Yeo has his hand raised.
Yes, Director Yeo, please.
Thank you, Chair Whitaker. My question is regarding this slide as well. So the potential additional 4,000 and 6,000 and with all the different numbers below it, are they the different scenarios of Monte Carlo simulations that they run? I'm speculating that. Like, you take all the factors into consideration and run a quantitative analysis like 10,000, 100,000 times, and this is the average that you're getting. Is that what it is?
So, Director Yeo, you want to know about the modeling nomenclature at the bottom of the graph? Is that right?
Yeah, because it looks like it's five different scenarios they run, right? And then the average is about 4,000 from the five different models. And then, whereas the other one, the orange bar charts, it's another
five scenarios average they run. Yeah, it's right. The average of all those models integrated together. Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure something like this, they would have to run like Monte Carlo simulation for quantitative analysis to get this. Because, you know, in the cartoon that you have a few slides ago, it's showing that we're going from 505 to 512 or 514. It's 20,000. Right, maybe it was the first one. Yeah, 505 to 514 is plus 20,000 acre feet, but obviously, we're not going to get that every year, right? And then so you take the history into consideration and everything else, and our recharging capacity. That's what the likely scenario is showing, right? On the average, I'm so sorry to make you go back. It was the very first one. Yeah, it showed like between 505 and 514 is plus 20K acre feet. But we're seeing 4,000 and 6,000. So that's why it kind of prompted me to think that these are different simulations that they run. And that's the likely, most likely scenario that each scenario would yield. In terms of annual acre feet of water that we're able to capture additionally.
Director Yeo, General Manager Kennedy seems to want to weigh in here.
Well, Adam and Lisa, so we're looking at past hydrology to come up with these numbers. It's the past 30 years. So it's,
yeah.
So the model looks back on what the hydrology has been the last 30 years. And calculates if we were able to store water up to, you know, 510 or 512 or 514, how much additional water would we have stored on average? There could be some years where we're not storing any more water because it's relatively dry. There could be some years where we get two pools, like twice maybe we store up to elevation 512 or 514. But on average, it's calculating based on the last 30 years of hydrology, how much, you know, additional water would be stored behind the dam at those different elevations.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It must have taken a bunch of factors into consideration. And at the end, when we run the simulation like, 100,000 times, and that's what it turns out, right? This is the most likely scenario that we're going to encounter every year. On the average.
So yes.
No, but basically what I'm trying to say is that there's some intelligence behind this, I hope. And I think so. So thank you.
Thank you, Director Yeo. Any other hands raised?
No.
Listening to the conversation, I think I'd be willing to stipulate that water impounded behind the dam is potential recharge, but there's no guarantee that it will become recharge at these various capture points. But I had a couple observations. One of your very earliest slides
prior to this one. I just wanted to commend you. The quality level of the scenic beauty of this
I can't take credit for it. I give you CW3E all the credit for that.
And one thing for you too, Adam, is you're recounting to us 80% cost participation by the federal government as a recognized pilot project for Tiro at Prado Dam. It leads me to believe that we need to convince Washington that OCWD was the nationwide pilot project for dealing with PFAS. And the last thing, at least for Lisa, it sounds like if it doesn't stop raining this year, we're going to be on the lookout for scuba diving archaeologists. That's pretty much it. Really good presentation, I think. Appreciate all the work that went into it. Oh, and I'll have some follow-up questions about where SAPA may interface on some of this as well. But that could be offline.
Director Sheldon has his hand raised.
Yes, Director Sheldon.
Okay, just one more. I have a lot more questions, but I think I'm going to schedule some time with Lisa and Adam, so I don't, so my colleagues don't shoot me or something for taking asking all my questions. On the cultural study in the current inundation of those areas to be studied, you can't get to them. Would there be any earth movement with the project? Because my understanding is we want to inundate it. And we can't study inundating it because it's currently inundated. So that doesn't make sense. Are we going to be, you know, having bulldozers out there moving some of the dirt where there may be some tribal remains? Or what is the what is the project for that area?
That's a great question. I should have clarified earlier. It does not involve any excavation work. It's more validating that the records that were found are real and exist at the elevations that were noted in the record.
What records?
So there are cultural records with the county that are filed as significant. So whenever you go do any kind of work, you have to do an investigation of cultural effect before you do a project. And so that it's what's on record, and you pull the record. The records are not always accurate. So you go back out to verify that the locations are accurate and the elevations are accurate.
That makes doesn't make much sense, but I'm going to let it go. Not that you're not making sense. I don't think what they're requiring makes sense because.
Oh, yeah. We all agree with that.
Yeah, it's the records. I've dealt with these cultural studies before, and the records are like, we found some spoons or this or that from 100 years ago or in a little bit of artifact. And that's all I've really seen a lot of these days. I haven't seen all of them, but.
Yeah.
But we're talking about inundating it, and that's all. We're not going to have excavators out. So it's.
No, and our point initially was it's already underwater naturally through flooding. So why do we have to do this piece? That was very confusing to me at the beginning. And the reason why, as explained to me in much detail, is it's a regulatory requirement that if there's a change in condition, this is a water conservation is a change in condition to flooding. If it was just flooding, there'd be no issue, but because we are asking to hold water for a longer period of time, that changes the condition and then initiates a cultural review. Whether it makes sense or not, that is the law.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing no further comments or questions, I would direct that the items 1 through 5 be placed on the calendar for our next March 20th Board of Directors meeting. And then there would be time as well for directors' announcements or reports. Seeing none? General manager's announcement report.
Nothing to report.
With that, we are adjourned.